So once again, and again, you know, I mean, we're dealing with this, but it wasn't really in the list of things that I have been contemplating doing, spending some time on the gifts, wasn't really something, but it went to 1 Corinthians 14. And we, you know, gave some attention to that. And I really thought, in light of that, that I ultimately wanted to spend some time talking about the role of women in the church, which I intend to do, but thought we might be somewhat benefited to at least work through this passage. And again, not primarily, you know, and I don't think that this happens much anymore, but when I was a new Christian, you know, one of the things that there was plenty of were all kinds of tests that you could take to find out what your giftedness was and all of that kind of stuff. And I don't really think that, Paul certainly isn't going there, and this is not the gist of the passage, and that's what my intention is to get at the gist of the passage. So we started in chapter 12. Paul made, a couple of points. He's obviously responding, if not to a question, but to an issue that is going on. We kind of talked about that. I mean, I think we can infer that that the Corinthians were talking about gifts. They were talking about what the best gift was. They were assuming that best gift meant best Christian, that you could measure the depth of Christianity or by the nature of the gift. And Paul has pointed out to them that there are many gifts, but there is only one body. And where I want to begin this morning, and I made reference to this last week, is begin with chapter 12 and verse number 31. Because it really is a statement that throws everybody back on their heels and causes us to kind of sit up and pose a question. Okay? 1 Corinthians 12:31 says, "But covet earnestly the best gifts, and yet show I unto you a more excellent way." Covet earnestly the best gifts, and yet show I unto you a more excellent way. So, and I had alluded to this last week. Let's just take a moment and go back and read a selection of verses to help us have the overall reason why I would say that verse number 31 would cause us to pull up short. Verse number 6 of chapter 12, "There are diversities of operations, but it is the same God which worketh all in all." So the gifts are the result of God. And verse 4 and 5 really are making the same point. It is the same God. Right? Who's at work? God is at work. Who gives the gift? God gives the gift. And He gives the gift, right? He gives a spiritual gift, a gift of grace, so that we individually have the ability to minister to other members of the body. They're not status symbols to magnify our prominence within the body. These are God's gifts to us. Verses 8 and 9, "For to one is given by the Spirit the word of wisdom, to another the word of knowledge by the same Spirit, to another faith by the same Spirit, to another the gifts of healing by the same Spirit." Verse number 11, "But all these worketh that one and the self same Spirit, dividing to every man severally as he will." Down to verse number 18. "But now hath God set the members, every one of them, in the body as it hath pleased him." Verse number 24. "For our comely parts have no need, but God hath tempered the body together, having given more abundant honor to that part which lacked." And then verse number 28. "And God hath set some in the church, first apostles, secondarily prophets, thirdly teachers, after that miracles, then gifts of healing, health, governments, diversities of tongues." So one of the major themes in the discussion of spiritual gifts is that God is the giver and the orchestrator of these gifts. And then Paul says, for us to covet the best gifts. So what do we, how do we interpret that? And by the way, that isn't the only place that Paul says it. If you jump ahead to chapter 14 and verse number 1, Paul says, follow after charity and desire spiritual gifts, but rather that ye may prophesy. And he says basically the same thing. Well, pretty much exactly the same thing in chapter 14 and verse number 12. Even so ye, for as much as ye are zealous of spiritual gifts, seek that ye may excel to the edifying of the church. So here's kind of the dilemma. What is Paul telling them? What is he saying to them? In other words, how do I reconcile this? Right? This is the work of God. This is the work of God. This is the work of God. And God has given you exactly what he wants you to do. And that means for some of us, we are going to fall into that realm of being less honorable, to use Paul's language here in our King James Bible. Some of us are going to have gifts that are like that, and we have them not because we are in any way inferior, but because this is clearly the will of God, because he's the one who gives the gift and orchestrates them for the betterment of the body, and yet covet the best gift. So how do I covet the best gift without in any way being critical of God for not giving me that gift? These are some of the things. And one commentator, you know, just says there's virtually no end to the way that we process this. So I thought I would take some of the more prominent options, or two of the more prominent options. I'm going to give you what I think, and that would be the way that I would deal with it. But all right. So if you look, by the way, at verse number 31, as you read chapter 12, verse number 31, covet earnestly the best gift, how would you interpret? I mean, I don't mean how would you interpret that. How would you, if Paul said that to you, how would you think of that? Are you being told what to do? This is what I'm getting at. Are we being told what to do? And by the way, frequently it is treated just like that. It is being treated as an imperative. Okay. I mean, if you get out the lexicon and look at it, covet earnestly is being treated there as an imperative. It is a command. Here's what I want you to do. Okay. One of the ways that it is interpreted, and this hinges upon some of the peculiarities and nuances of Greek grammar, which we're not going to get into, but that Paul isn't really using it as an imperative. He's using it as what we would call an indicative. And Paul isn't giving a command, he's just simply making a statement of fact. Now, obviously, our King James translators haven't translated it with that sentiment. In other words, they are not saying, because this is the way you would have to reword it if you treated it that way, but you are coveting earnestly the best gifts. So, right, all these things that I've told you about the way God is doing it, you guys are in error. You are coveting the best gifts, and you shouldn't be doing that. And so Paul is treating this as a rebuke to them. You are making much out of the best gifts. You are ignoring the other gifts. And since God is the one who is giving the gifts, you shouldn't be doing that. Now, again, obviously, folks, our version doesn't most versions don't translate it that way. If you start looking at other versions that people in even our world would use, you don't find it translated that way. I will say this, and I'm not doing this to anyone. I mean, John MacArthur is you know, he just would say publicly, I treat it as an indicative. They are coveting the gifts. Paul is rebuking them for doing it. Second option, one of the major ways of dealing with it, is that Paul is quoting back to them something that they say. And without getting all into that this morning, this is something that happens in Corinthians. we are very confident that, right, meets for the bond. We're going to look at this passage in a couple of weeks on Sunday morning. Meats for the belly and the belly for meats. All things are lawful for me. We believe in those kind of instances that what Paul is doing is quoting something that the Corinthians say. And there's a whole body of literature on the slogans of the Corinthians. And again, guys that, you know, are all about this kind of stuff, study them, analyze them. But invariably, well, not invariably, because there are guys who argue this. So what's happening here, right, is that the Corinthians say, this is one of their slogans, covet earnestly the best gifts. Covet the best gifts. And so Paul is quoting them. But it really doesn't fit, I don't think, with the flow, and it doesn't really fit with the kind of formula that you find when Paul is quoting them. But again, the argument would be Paul is not really rebuking them. He's correcting them. In either case, a common way of dealing with verse number 31 is that Paul is correcting their misguided thinking. And I think that there is some truth to that just because of the way the verse is stated. But so what I think is the best way to deal with it is that Paul is in fact instructing them to be zealous for the best gifts. That Paul is in fact instructing them to be zealous for the best gifts. And then what Paul is doing is, I've got it on the outline, they're constraining or directing their zeal. Covet the best gifts. And here's what I think, folks. Shouldn't any church, shouldn't Westwood Heights be zealous for the best gifts? Shouldn't a church be zealous for the best gifts? Shouldn't we want people in our assembly to have the best gifts? In other words, and I think this is where Paul is going with this. All right? When I read the word covet, right, I immediately default to sin in my mind. So that if I'm coveting something, I have a sinful desire for something. But that really isn't the way the word is always used. In the Greek, the word it is the word zeal. It doesn't just mean zeal, it is the word zeal. We've taken the Greek word zeal and turned it into covet. And sometimes we turn it into zeal. So here's where I think Paul is going, and I just think that the context of the way he writes lends itself to that. All right? Here's the Corinthian flaw. So I think there's a corrective there. The Corinthian flaw is the best Christians have the best gifts. The best gifts are the most prominent gifts. And so I want to be the guy who gets the microphone, so to speak. I want to be the guy who's center stage. I want that gift. Whatever gift puts me in front of the most people, whatever gift puts me at the greatest position of prestige, whichever gift gives me the greatest center of attention, that's the gift that I want. That's the wrong way to be zealous for the gifts. But one of the things that Paul instructs the Philippians, though he would certainly instruct the Corinthians, was to let every man esteem others better than themselves. So is it possible, is it what God is expecting, is it what God is teaching, that it would be possible for me to be zealous for you to have the best gift and to use that gift for my betterment? And one of the things that Paul said to the church of Corinth very early in the letter was that they came behind in no gift. And it would be obvious, folks, I think, if we thought about this, that not every local assembly is going to be able to say that. Certainly, the more members you have in a local assembly, the more, maybe not a different amount of gifts, because we don't really know exactly how many spiritual gifts there are. But if a church was a church of 5,000, let's just say for the sake of argument, there are 100 spiritual gifts and there is a church of 1,000, then the ratio would be greatly different than if there are 100 spiritual gifts and there's a congregation of 50. That church is perhaps going to come behind in the gifts. It's not going to be able to minister as fully or as effectively because it just simply doesn't have the quantity of gifts. So a church ought to desire to have the very best gifts. Now, what those best gifts are, or what the best gift is, maybe would be the better question. That's another thing that Paul's going to have to tackle and he's going to have to fix for them. But I just think that what Paul is doing is giving them a very simple command in light of everything else that I know about Christianity, which is that I can be zealous for something that you have. I don't have to only be zealous for what I have. And in fact, part of my spiritual depth is my ability to be zealous for what you have. Look, if you have the best gift, folks, and if you're exercising that best gift biblically, I'm going to be the recipient of that benefit, right? Because the gift is given for the benefit of the body. So, I'm getting ready to be gone this week. I'm going to a Bible conference, right? There are guys that I'm going there to hear speak. I am blessed when I hear them speak. So, why can't I be zealous for their gift? So that would be the way that I think that Paul is viewing it. So I would be comfortable with viewing it as an imperative and bring the entire body of Christian doctrine to bear. That he's not encouraging them to be disgruntled at the Lord because they don't have the best gift, but that within the framework of the entire body, to be zealous for the body to have the best gift. We are a body. We are not a club. I mean, we are not an alumni association. We are a living body of God's people. And that constitutes then a very different relationship. So, but every time Paul says that to them, they should be zealous for the best gifts. And the word best there means most useful. When he says covet earnestly the best gift, he means the most useful gift. That's really what the word best means. The one that it has the, what gift has the greatest utility in an assembly of God's people? That's the question. What gift is indispensable? And he's ultimately going to tackle that. But again, folks, every time Paul says this to them, he is in some way, I've got up there restraining, that may not be the best word. He is in some way instructing that zeal. For instance, just look at chapter 12 and verse number 31. Covet earnestly the best gifts, and yet show I unto you a more excellent way. So be zealous for the gifts in the body, but there's something better. And again, folks, we want always to remember that the Corinthians are imbued with this spirit of competition. I mean, even right to the way that they take the Lord's Supper, it is kind of a, how can I display that I'm better than you, that I'm superior to you? How do I do that? So I'm going to show you something even better. And I think that Paul certainly means, because he's not going to contradict what he has written, and the Spirit of God is not going to lose his place that quickly, that I can be zealous for the best gifts without in any way dishonoring or demeaning those gifts that are not the best, because I might be the one who possesses those gifts. But all right, so I mean, I've kind of already gone off on this, because it is very possible and I think desirable for us to be eager for a local assembly to have the best gifts, even if we're not the one in possession of that gift. And that's what he's really... I turned it off, Brian. Not only do I have the clumsy thumbs, I've got a Band-Aid on one, so I turned it off. In fact, folks, if you look, and I've already had you look at it, but in chapter 12 and verse number 31, he says, "Covet earnestly the best gifts, and yet show I unto you a more excellent way." And then in chapter 14 and verse number 1, "Follow after charity and desire spiritual gifts, but rather that ye may prophesy." He just really kind of goes right back to what he'd been talking about. The subject matter of spiritual gifts comes right back. But more excellent, superior to the presence of a gift is the practice of love. What is the best gift? Well, to the Corinthians, it appears that the best gift was the gift of tongues. That was how they viewed it. And Paul talks to them in chapter 12 about tongues. And he will return to the subject matter of tongues in chapter 14. But to Paul, clearly the best gift was the gift of prophecy. What is the most useful gift in a body of believers? The most useful gift in the body of believers is the gift of prophecy. And why that is, Paul will enumerate in chapter 14. All of the things that prophecy can do. Let me back that up. All of the ways in which prophecy contributes to one thing, which is the building of the body. Prophecy builds the body. Tongues do not build the body. But prophecy does. And so prophecy then is the best gift in the sense of being most useful to the body. And yet, there is something even better. Before he talks to them about the utility of gifts, he talks to them about the priority of love. And if you look, folks, at chapter 12 again and verse number 31 and verse number chapter 13, which we will look at, love transcends all gifts. Love is not a gift. Love is not a spiritual gift. Some of us are going to have the gift of prophecy. Some of us may have the gift of wisdom or the gift of knowledge. Some may have the gift of helps. But nobody has the gift of love. Love is not a gift. Everybody is supposed to love. Everybody has Bible criteria for love. Everybody has the biblical expectation to love. Those that don't have the gift of prophecy, folks, are not expected to be prophets. Again, this is something we don't always do well in our churches, but this is the way that God would view it. All right? So, chapter 13, verses 1 through 3. Chapter 13, verses 1 through 3, Paul is making this argument, and that is, love is indispensable. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I am become as sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have not charity, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing. So, in this passage, in these three verses, this would be, again, my assessment, my understanding. Number one, Paul is speaking to them in hypothetical superlatives. And I don't want to get all down into this road, folks, right? But today, in the modern world, we have a big debate about what tongues actually are. And there was a guy, I can't remember now if somebody sent it to me and I saw it on Twitter or I saw it on YouTube. But a guy who was uttering basically gibberish that he was claiming was speaking in tongues. And then he was on his phone, checking his phone, while he's speaking in heavenly languages. Just all things kind of goofball. Biblically, tongues are just normal languages. I mean, the first instance of tongues is Acts chapter 2. Everybody heard their native language. There's no reason to think that Paul means anything differently. And unless you come to 1 Corinthians 13:1 and conclude that Paul is teaching that there are heavenly languages that we can speak. And again, without going... Let me ask you a question, folks. What language have you ever heard an angel speak in? And I'm not trying to be funny here. What language have you heard an angel speak in? I was going to say, when I take my Bible and read it, every time an angel is talking, he's talking English. That's the language I get angels in. The angel that was talking to Jacob was talking English. That's what I have. The angel that appeared to John the Baptist's parents, he was talking English. There is no record of any angel talking any language other than the language of the person they were talking to. So anyway, so I think we should think of verses 1 through 3, folks, because this is what Paul is trying to point. I want to show you a better way. Covet the best gifts. Desire the best gifts. A church needs the best gifts. But church needs something more than it needs the best gifts. There's something greater than the exercise of the gifts. And so we have these hypothetical superlatives. So let's just kind of walk through them. Okay? What if you could? Chapter 13, verse number 1. What if you could speak with the tongues of men? When I first went to UNO, the first class that I took was taught by the chairman of the history department. This man could speak 6 or 7 languages. I don't remember now. Spoke several of the European languages. And he could talk in the European languages. Supposing you could do that. Supposing that we had a guest come in and all they spoke was Spanish. You go, I got it. I can speak Spanish. And then the next week somebody came in from Germany and you could speak German. And then the next week somebody from Russia came in and you could speak Russian. Supposing you could do that. And then supposing one week one of those angels that the Bible talks about in Hebrews chapter 13 shows up that was unaware and they were speaking a heavenly language and suppose you could talk that too. So supposing that you could, folks, I mean, right, let's not blast through Paul's words. Let's think through these. Supposing that was you. Now, let me just ask you a question. If there was somebody like that in a local assembly, what do you suppose their reputation in the assembly would be? If there was somebody that could handle a variety of human languages and the occasional heavenly language if we needed it, what would their status in the church be? I think it would be pretty high, right? Everybody would know who that person was. Right? If your job was to be standing at the back door greeting folks and somebody came in and they started talking a language and you thought, I don't know what language that is because it's not my language. You would say, but we have somebody in the church that speaks that language. You'd know who they were, right? They would have that kind of prominence at least. All right, so let's follow Paul's line of thinking. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, supposing somebody really could do that, and yet they did not have charity, which is agape, they did not have love, how does that render them? Again, folks, you have to remember that Paul is writing to people who think that something like that is really cool and worth having. Right? Not only do the Corinthians think that it would be cool to be that person, you got a lot of people in the pew who want to be that person, who desire to have that for themselves. That would be really cool. Listen. Okay, and I'm not trying to be those people. When I got saved and I had no religious background whatsoever. We got saved, and we started to go to church, and then you find out that there are Sunday school teachers. That's pretty cool. Right? And then you find out that there are these deacons. And that was pretty cool. Didn't really quite understand that, but all I knew was that everybody seemed to have a lot of respect for deacons. I thought, I'd like to be a deacon. That would be pretty cool. It would be pretty cool to walk through and hit people, oh, he's a deacon. Now, I've been a pastor for 35 years. I would just like you to know that all the coolness have been squeezed out of it, okay? It's not cool. It is not glamorous. I no longer think of it that way. But that's a relatively immature way to think about it. So this, and this, by the way, is the problem that the Corinthians have. They're very immature about these kinds of things. How does Paul describe them? Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I am become a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. Or what if you could do this? Verse number 2. And though I have the gift of prophecy, now that's the one Paul values, and understand all mysteries, and he's referring back to some of the things that he's already listed in chapter 12, and all knowledge. So supposing that in the church you were the knowledge guy. And mysteries are things, right? Mysteries are not whodunit. Mysteries are things that God chooses to reveal in His timing, like why marriage functions the way that it does, because it's a picture of the relationship between Christ and the church. Even the very existence of the church is a mystery that God chose to reveal in His time that people didn't grasp and didn't understand. Nobody could figure out. But supposing you were the go-to guy, so that anybody in the church, they were having a conversation and go, I wonder why it's like this. They could go to you and you go, well, here's why. Because God told me why. Once again, folks, it would be pretty cool to be you from that standpoint. Or supposing that you were the faith guy. Supposing you were the kind of faith, right? I mean, Jesus just kind of threw it out there as something that everybody ought to do. Right? If you had faith the size of a mustard seed, you'd move mountains. Now look at the way Paul puts it. Supposing you were that guy. He doesn't view every guy as being that guy. He views a relatively small segment of the assembly being that guy. Supposing that was you. You were the faith guy. That's verse number 2. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mystery and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, supposing you were that guy. Once again, folks, right? Here's two people in the church talking about a problem and something unsolvable, and somebody says, you know what? We need to stop talking about this. We need to go talk to the faith guy. We need to get him involved. Because he can move mountains. Then Paul adds a third, again, hypothetical superlative. Verse number 3, and though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned. Well, boy, you're just out of stuff to give, aren't you? I mean, literally, right? This is one of the reasons, folks, that what we have here are these hypothetical superlatives. If you gave everything you owned and then you gave your body to be burned, what would you have left? What would you have left to give? You've already given all that you have. Right? We have taken the marvel of Acts chapter 2 and we have buried it under the rubble of this man. Right? Barnabas got biblical mention for having a piece of property and selling it and giving the money to the church. And it turned the church on its head. What if the church had this guy? He gave everything. Right? He came in one Sunday and said to the pastor, can I sleep on the pew tonight? I sold the house. I gave the money. I got rid of the car. Cleaned out the garage. Cleaned out the shed. Gave away all my fishing tackle. Sold the golf clubs. Pawned them at Saul's, got rid of everything. I have nothing left. And then the next week, in his final act of devotion, he gives his body to be burned. Supposing that was what happened, and yet all of those people acted without love. And you'll notice that what he's doing here, folks, is he's comparing, right? He is comparing the two things that are the main topics of discussion to the Corinthians' tongues, to Paul prophecy. Well, what if Paul, and you notice, by the way, that he refers to himself this way. Though I speak with the tongue of men and angels, and I have the gift of prophecy, and I bestow all my goods, and yet there is no love, what is the consequence of that? What is the consequence of that? All right, so, right, with reference to verse number one, what is he talking about there? I am become sounding brass or tinkling cymbal. I am an unwelcome noise. I am an unwelcome noise. I am talking and talking and talking in all these languages and talking and talking and talking in heavenly languages. And you know what I am? I'm noise. Noise, the dictionary definition of noise is unwanted sound. I'm just noise. Again, folks, I mean, right? Paul is, I'm not saying Paul is not trying to be cute. Paul is trying to be pointed. Sounding brass. Clang, clang. I mean, I really thought about trying to track down, well, just even bring in a couple of lids to pots and just bang them. Right? Just bang the cymbals. Isn't it good? Don't you like that? I can play the cymbals. Bang, 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 bang. What do we say to children when they do that? Stop making all that noise. Stop making all that noise. That's what we say. So what would the Lord say to somebody who is all puffed up about the fact that they got all these languages, even heavenly ones? God would say, stop making all that noise. Secondly, if I have all this knowledge and all this faith, notice the way Paul describes himself, I am nothing. I am the cipher. Again, folks, we want to think through this clearly because at least in the mind of the Corinthians, if not in the minds of many Christians, that would be the cool guy. That would be the cool thing. To be the go-to guy. I want to be the go-to guy. Right? I want to be the guy that everybody seeks out because I know and I understand and I can explain and I believe and I can get things done with God. And everybody comes to me. And wouldn't that be cool? Wouldn't it be cool to be me? But if there's no love, folks, that guy is nothing. And what if you did? What if you did give all your goods so that you had to sleep in a pew? And then you gave your own body to be burned so that you had exhausted all that you had to give and that there was no love. There would be no profit. You would get no gain at all from it. But I've given everything I have. Yeah, to no end. To no end. So all of the gifts and all of the excitement and all of the zeal for the variety of ways in which God has tempered the body together to make it work, without love, it's just nothing. It's just nothing. In verses 4 through 7, and I really just want to read through this because it's just like I read through the list of gifts without trying to develop them. In verses 4 through 7, just to help us outline the chapter, verses 1 through 3, Paul is talking about the fact that love is indispensable. In verses 4 through 7, he is talking about the characteristics of love. What is biblical love like? Charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up. Doth not behave itself unseemly, doth not seek her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth, beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. So Paul gives here some of the attributes. Roughly, they can be broken down into things that love is and things that love isn't. Love is some things. It is not other things. I would point out to you, first of all, folks, that all of these characteristics are practical. They are not sentimental. There is a place for what we call sentiment. Right? Jesus was moved with compassion. He had strong feelings for people. But that may be a reflection of his love, but it is not a characteristic all by itself of love. These are very concrete, specific, practical attributes of love. It is long-suffering. It is long-suffering. It puts up with a lot. It is kind. Bears all things, really has the idea of being rather protective. It is hopeful. It loves truth. It endures. Biblically, folks, there's no such thing as falling out of love. That's the sentimental side of things. We're talking about biblical love. It endures. It keeps on. It's not a feeling. It is an enduring attribute. It does not boast about itself. It is not inflated. It does not act unbecomingly, which almost always refers to sexual impropriety. It doesn't act unbecomingly. It isn't selfish. It isn't easily provoked. It doesn't assume the worst. And it doesn't love iniquity. It loves truth, not sinfulness. These are the attributes of genuine, authentic, biblical love. So verses 1 through 3, Paul outlines the fact that it is indispensable, that it transcends every other gift. And 4 through 7, Paul explains what he means by love. This is how God defines love. And then in verses 8 through 13, and I just want to read them, because next week we'll come back and look at them in a little more depth. But love outlasts any gift. This is really where he's going, folks. Right? Again, the Corinthians, all about the gifts. And the gifts are necessary. God has put the gifts in the individual parts of the body for the betterment of the body. But charity never faileth, verse number 8. But whether they be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether they be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known. And now abideth faith, hope, charity. These three, but the greatest of these is charity. Love outlasts any gift. Love outlasts any gift. And I think you understand why when I read through those that we want to give some attention to them, because there's a wide body of disagreement over verse number 10, what the perfect is and when it's coming. Right? When that which is perfect is come. The gifts will end. When will they end? When that which is perfect will come. Well, when is that? When is that? And so we'll try and turn our attention to that next week. All right, that's what I have this morning. Questions, comments, critiques, observations? You're so subdued. It certainly can't be that anybody who seriously thought the Huskers were going to win yesterday, did it?